Good morning, Fenton Crossing and all my friends. As today, we're going to talk about some things that been thinking about for the last 3 weeks, the Book of Esther. I've been doing a devotional with Swindoll, and some things came to mind that I thought we would just talk about this morning. In 1976, Gordon Lightfoot, in his song, The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald, recounts the events of that tragic night, November 10th, 1975. What happened was he read an article in Newsweek called The Cruelest Month, and he wrote the song according to that article. You have a over 700-foot ship loaded with 50,000 tons 50,000 pounds of iron ore, and they're heading for Cleveland across Lake Superior. Traveling in the month of November is risky because the storms start, and that day the storm started. It began with the wind. It went to waves starting to come over the railing. Before you knew it, you were in 25-foot waves surging to 35 feet, with 70-mile-an-hour winds gusting to about 90. The ship that he was traveling with said that there were 35-foot waves with winds gusting to about 90 miles an hour. 35-foot seas. I remember one time we went on a cruise and we went to Alaska, coming up around the Bering Sea up there, that we were in 12-foot seas, in a ship that was probably, now get this, a football field longer than the Edmund Fitzgerald. And when the bow would come out of the water and settle back down, the stern would come out of the water and the propellers would be out of the water and they would rattle. And they call that the death rattle. It shook the whole ship. And that was just in 12-foot seas. These guys were in 25 to 35 foot seas, and what they were doing, they were sailing blind. They lost their radar. They had no radar. The only communication was with a nearby ship trying to guide them. They were 15 miles from a place called Whitefish Bay, where the lighthouse on the point was not working, so that was no help at all. The song is true to the article. Probably at dinner time, which was about 5 o'clock at night, it was just too rough to eat. At about 7 o'clock was the last communication where Captain McSorley communicated with the nearby ship that he was holding his own. 10 minutes later at 7:10 p.m., the Edmund Fitzgerald sank to the bottom of Lake Superior, over 500 feet below the surface. All of that to say this. In one of the lines in the song, the writer asks the question, does anyone know where the love of God goes when the waves turn the minutes to hours? Where are you, Lord? Why so silent? Do you hear me? Do you hear me in my misery? Why don't you answer? Job asked the question, even today is my complaint bitter. My stroke is heavier than my groaning. Oh, that I knew where I might find him, that I might come even to his seat. We've all been there. We've all asked the question, where are you, Lord? Why don't you hear me when I cry? I remember riding to work many days, struggling with some things in my life with my child. And I remember asking, is this real? Or are you real? Is this faith real? It's been so long. And I haven't heard from you. Why are you so silent? Where are you, Lord? Now, as we look at the Book of Esther this morning, I want to establish the point of the book. And that is this: the demonstration of God's providential care of his people. Even when we are in despair and feel that God is nowhere to be found, he's there. He is there working. And even though it looks like he's not there, he doesn't hear us. He doesn't hear us when we cry. He is always there. That's the point this morning. It may look like he's gone. It may look like he's not answering, but he's there. And that's the point that I want you to hang on to this morning. Providence means the protective care of God, seeing the affairs of life before they happen. Providential cares involving divine foresight are intervention. We may not see the end, but God does, and he is working. So for us today, it means that no matter what we're going through, when God is silent and we feel he does not hear our cry, he is always there. He is always caring for us. God's will for our lives is unfolded through divine providence day by day. He is committed to us by the blood of his son. He is working and he will never forsake us. Isaiah reminds us of that. Can a woman forget her nursing child or have no compassion for the child of her womb? Even these mothers may forget, but as for me, I will never forget you. Look, I've inscribed you on the palms of my hands, and your walls are forever before me. Nowhere is this more evident than in the book of Esther. All of the things that Esther and Mordecai go through, and we find that God is never mentioned in the book, not one time, but he is there. We will see that God is directing many tiny events for the bringing about of his people's deliverance. And that's the point of the book. Again, I just want to say this. It is the revelation of God working behind the scenes in great providence for his people's well-being and protection. As I mentioned already, the book of Esther is a great example of God's care. He seems to be absent. He is never mentioned, but he himself is at work in the lives of Esther and Mordecai. What's interesting about that is that no miraculous intervention is resorted to. All of the things that happen are the outworking of circumstances in their natural order, which is a miracle in itself. God manipulates all the non-miraculous events to bring about the outcome that he wants. He achieves this outcome without the need for using miracles, which makes the book of Esther all the more miraculous. Ultimately, we will find at the end of the book that the events turn around completely from the way they were at the beginning of the book. I do want to remind us that sometimes it doesn't always turn out so well. It didn't for the Edmund Fitzgerald. 29 lives lost. God doesn't have a wonderful plan for everyone's life. Sometimes it includes hurt, loss, loneliness. But one thing we know for sure is that God is working. We need to believe that. Even when he is silent, I asked the question this morning, do we trust him in that time? God not only rules over major issues in life, but he also uses the small things in life to accomplish exactly what he wants done. So we look at the book of Esther this morning, and again, just Esther and Mordecai have no idea what is going on. And the first point that I want to look at is when the king summons the queen. In verses, chapter 1, verse 10 and 11, the king is having a party. He's filled with wine, as it is mentioned there. And he says, you know what? Get the queen out here. I want everyone to see how beautiful she is. I want to parade her in front of everybody so that they can see her beauty. Well, in verse 12, the queen refuses. I don't know if her integrity was being compromised, but she refused to be paraded in front of all these men. Just reviewing the chapter in verse 15, the question is asked, what do we do here? What do we do? In verse 16 and 18, there's great fear that this is what every woman will do. Guys, it's a Virginia Slims kind of moment here. You've come a long way, baby, and you have this male chauvinist that says, if we don't correct this, not only does she do harm to you, king, she is doing harm to all the princes in the province, because all the women will do this. They will dishonor their husband. And remember, at this time, Esther has no idea what's going on. God is working behind the scenes. No matter how carnal this looks, God is still working. And so we move on to chapter 2, and you have what we call a beauty contest. And in verses 1 through 4, it says that what we need to do here, king, is we need to send men out to all the provinces, and we need to pick the fairest of the women, and we will parade each one of them in front of the king. So what you have is a nationwide beauty contest. Probably 25 million women reduced to 400, eventually coming down to Esther. So in verses 5-7 of chapter 2, at this point, in the middle of 50 million people in the Persian Empire, we are introduced to Esther and her cousin Mordecai. Esther's a nobody. She has no parents, and now she is held captive in Persia. The only family she has is her cousin Mordecai, who has raised her as his own daughter. God did not forget her. He didn't forget her like Job. He didn't forget her like Joseph, Elijah, Moses, Paul, and on and on. God is quietly moving, and sometime soon, Esther would be the key to the deliverance of the Jews. So you get to verse 8, and out of all the women, Esther is picked. The contest went from however many women there were down to what historians say was about 400, and Esther is one of them. She goes quietly, trusting God. Let me just say this. I want to interject something. On the human level, there are two results of providence, the protective care of God on the human level. To those who recognize it in God's absence, there is great confidence and courage. To those who don't, there is panic and punishment. We will see that in the characters of Mordecai and Esther, and also in Haman. On the divine level, the result of providence is that God progresses toward his ultimate goal. Throughout scripture, we see this mighty behind the scenes movement. And just a side note, one of the possible contributing factors for the sinking of the Edmund Fitzgerald was complacency. The United States Coast Guard Marine Board issued the following conclusion. The nature of Great Lakes shipping with short voyages, much of the time in very protected waters, frequently with the same routine from trip to trip, leads to complacency and an overly optimistic attitude concerning the extreme weather conditions that can and do exist. The Marine Board feels that this attitude reflects itself at times in deferral of maintenance and repairs, in failure to prepare properly for heavy weather, and in the conviction that since refuges are near, safety is possible by running for it. While it is true that sailing conditions are good during the summer season, changes can occur abruptly with severe storms and extreme weather and sea conditions arising rapidly. This tragic accident points out the need for all persons involved in Great Lakes shipping to foster increased awareness of the hazards which exist. I asked the question this morning, when we are in despair and God is silent, are we prepared? Is there complacency from a day-to-day walking with God that when troubled time comes, that we're not prepared for it? And we don't trust him. Mordecai was. Mordecai knew exactly what God was doing. So was Joseph. Job was prepared. Elijah, Moses, Paul. They trusted God in his silence, and they believed the promises that he gave them. There was never complacency. They were prepared. Like them, we not only need to be prepared for the tragedies in our lives, and we think that God is nowhere to be found, but we need to trust him in the silence, knowing he is there, working his will in our lives. God will complete his plans. We determine our own destiny as we cooperate with his will or oppose it, but they do not frustrate God's plan. So it goes on. In verse 11, it says that Mordecai was still there, concerned about Esther, walking back and forth outside in the king's court. He is there. Verse 12 of chapter 2 tells us that these women prepared 12 months at a time for this thing, how to look, how to act, how to speak. And again, Esther and Mordecai have no idea what's going on. So Esther becomes queen in chapter 2, verse 15. All of the women are picked, are paraded before the king. And I want to say that when they went before the king, they had the opportunity to take whatever they needed out of the beautification to help their chances to become queen. It says here that Esther took nothing. She just went before the king. How do you stand out like this? Esther not only stole the beautification, the man that was helping her, not only stole his heart, but she stole the king's heart. An uncertain nobody, a Jewish orphan, a child of exiled, conquered people, is exalted to the highest position that a woman could have in the entire world. How does it happen? It happens because there is a greater power than the king working here. MacArthur said there's a power at work providentially, orchestrating his own purposes through the affections of the emperor. So Esther has no idea what's going on, neither does Mordecai. So after Esther is promoted to queen, Mordecai just happens to be in a place where he hears a conversation, which is point number three. Mordecai saves the king's life. And this is great. This is where the story starts to pick up. In verse 21 and through 23, Mordecai just happens to be hanging out, and he hears two guys talking about how they're going to take the king's life. Mordecai tells Esther, Esther tells the king, and the king says, I want this recorded in the book of Chronicles in verse 23. In the presence of the king, it's recorded. This was done so that he could one day go back and read everything that was ever recorded and reward those that were loyal to him. And this is not just a story about Mordecai. This is a chronicle that has been written and recorded for who knows how many years. So remember that. Remember, God is working, and Esther and Mordecai have no idea what's going on. You get to chapter 3, and we are introduced to a guy named Haman. Verses chapter 3, 1 through 2, 1 and 2. He gets promoted, and he doesn't like Mordecai because Mordecai will not bow down to him. Because of that, in verse 6, Haman wants to destroy all the Jews, not just Mordecai, but he wants to destroy all the Jews. In verse 6 of chapter 3, it says, and he held back to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had made known to him the people of Mordecai. Wherefore, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews that were throughout the whole kingdom of the king. So he has a plan that he is not only going to get Mordecai, but he wants to wipe out all of the Jews. Well, just looking at chapter 4, Mordecai hears about it. In verses 1 through 3, he's in disarray. He tears his clothes. And Esther finds out about it and cares for Mordecai by sending him clothes and sends a gentleman named Hathach to Mordecai to find out what's going on. Mordecai sends him back with a copy of the decree and a message that she should go to the king. Now, just a few words about that. In verses 10 and 11, Esther sends back the message that she can't unless she is called otherwise. She'll be put to death. I thought it was interesting Mordecai's response in verse 13 and 14. It says this. Then Mordecai commanded to answer Esther. Esther, think not thyself that you shall escape in the king's house more than the Jews. For if you altogether hold your peace at this time, then shall there be relief and deliverance arise to the Jews from another place. But you and your father's house shall be destroyed. And who knows whether you are come to the kingdom for such a time as this. I thought this was interesting. Think about it, Esther. You were an orphaned little girl who was raised by your own cousin. You are now held captive in Persia. You were picked, the only one out of 400 women to be queen. We had no idea what was going on. Look what God has done and where he has brought us. Think about it, Esther. Maybe he has put you here for this very purpose. Great words from Mordecai to Esther. He affirms his confidence in what God had promised, that he would preserve his people. But he also understands that if Esther doesn't act, they both could perish. We all know what Esther does, and we all know the famous line that she says at the end of verse 14, at the end of verse 16. I will go to the king, which is not according to the law, and if I perish, I perish. I don't know if what she said is exactly what she was thinking. I think what Esther had on her mind was the same thing that Corrie ten Boom was thinking when she said, there is no pit so deep that he is not deeper still. And so she goes before the king. Point number four, the banquets. Esther wants to have a banquet. And again, remember, God is never mentioned, but you see these things unfolding, knowing that God is in control of everything. So in chapter 5, verses 1 through 5, the king calls in Esther and says, what do you want, Esther? She goes in and she requests a banquet for the king and Haman. The idea was to tell the truth about what Haman was plotting while he was in the presence of the king. Something must not have been right. So she says, can we do this again tomorrow? Perhaps God was working and decided to do it another way. Remember the Chronicles. Remember the Chronicles. So in verses 6 through 8, while the first banquet is going on, the king says, what do you want to do, Esther? She says, if it's all right with you, king, I would like to do this again tomorrow. So she requests another banquet. The king summons Haman and he says, hey, we're going to do this again tomorrow. In verses 9 through 14, Haman leaves and he is happy because he has been invited again to a banquet that is being thrown by the queen. He's on his way home and he sees Mordecai. Mordecai doesn't stand up. He doesn't tremble before him. So he calls his friends. He goes home and tells his friends what's going on. But before he does that, he says to them, guys, I got to tell you, the king and queen are having a banquet and there's only two men that are invited, the king and me. And I want to tell you about all the riches and my promotion. But most importantly, I want to tell you I've been invited, just me, to the banquet of the king. He goes, the only problem I have is this Mordecai won't get out of my way. He won't worship me. He won't bow down. He won't do anything. What should I do? Well, his friends and his wife say, here, let's build a gallows. We'll hang him on it. Mordecai says, that's a great idea. And I'm telling you, this is where the story really gets good. Mordecai goes to sleep after building the gallows, probably dreaming about his revenge the next day. And the fifth point I want to make is while he's doing that, something is going on in the palace, in the king's palace. And this is where we see the ultimate providential control of God in everyday circumstances. Chapter 6, 1 through 3, while Mordecai is sleeping, dreaming about his execution of Mordecai, or while Haman is sleeping, dreaming about his execution of Mordecai, in chapter 6, the king can't sleep. He can't go to sleep. So what he does is he calls for someone to read him the Chronicles. Chapter 6, verses 4 through 14. He wakes up, verses 1 through 3, and he says, I can't sleep. So he calls somebody to read the Chronicles. And in the very place that they open the book is what Mordecai did for him, saving his life. We read on in verses 4 through 14. Haman is on his way to talk to the king about hanging Mordecai the next day. So the king says, after hearing the Chronicles, who's in the court? And they said, well, Haman is. The king calls Haman, calls him in, and before Haman can say anything about hanging Mordecai, the king asks the question, Haman, how would you honor a guy who saves my life? In verse 6 of chapter 6, Haman says, what shall be done for the man whom the king delights to honor? Haman thought in his heart, to whom would the king delight to honor more than me? So Haman thinks it's him the king's talking about. Haman answers in verses 7 through 9. I'll tell you what I'd do, king. I would bring all the royal apparel, and then I would have a parade for this guy. And then I would have somebody going before the parade saying, this is the guy in whom the king's heart delights. The king says, okay, Haman, what I want you to do in verse 10 and 11, let it be done for Mordecai. What a turn of events. So Haman is the guy who has to lead the parade for Mordecai. And everywhere he goes, he says, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. In verses 12 through and 13, when it's over, Haman goes home in disbelief. He looks for comfort, but he doesn't find it. His friends are there. His wife and his friends, they tell him, they warn him. They say, Haman, if this is a Jewish man that is being honored by the king, and you're trying to wipe him out, it will not happen. You will not prevail. Reminds me of Pilate's wife when she came to him and said, don't mess with him, Pilate. This guy is not your normal guy. Don't mess with him. And so his wife says, you will not prevail, Haman. Okay, so in verse 14, he's summoned for the banquet again at the end of chapter 6. So in move on to chapter 7, verses 1 through 6, they are both summoned to the banquet. And the king says, what's on your mind, Esther? And Esther says, King, I have to tell you, our people are being sold and we are going to be murdered. And the king says, it's impossible. Who would this one be who is going to do this to you? And she says, I hate to say this, but the enemy is Haman. The king in verse 7, the king arising from the banquet of wine in his wrath went into the palace garden, and Haman stood up to make request for his life to Esther, the queen, for he saw that there was evil determined against him by the king. So the king gets angry. He walks out. Haman stands up and says, Queen, please have mercy on me. He falls down in verse 8 at the feet of Esther. The king walks back in and he thinks that Esther's attacking the queen. Look what happens in verse 9. Verse 9 and 10. Then one of the chamberlains in attendance upon the king said, Behold also the gallows 50 cubits high, which Haman had built for Mordecai, who had spoken good for the king. It stands in Haman's backyard. Then the king said, Hang him on it. So they hanged Haman on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. Then was the king's wrath pacified. Long after Haman was hanged, Mordecai and Esther continued to flourish in the royal house of the king. The king exalted Mordecai to the second in command and continued to love his queen. Against all odds, Esther, Mordecai, and the Jews had been spared, not only spared, but elevated. And we see that in chapter 10, verse 3. What a story. God never mentioned, yet he is working behind the scenes of everything that is going on, every small detail in the lives of Esther, Mordecai, Haman, and the king. So I asked the question this morning, does anyone know where the love of God goes when the waves turn the minutes to hours? Where is God in the book of Esther? He is never mentioned, but he is there. His hand of providence is made obvious in every single tiny detail. Filtering down 25 million women to one, a Jew chosen to be queen. Mordecai being in a place where he could hear a plot and warn the king. The king not being able to sleep and decides to read the royal record. And out of all the places that could have been read to him, he reads about Mordecai being unrewarded. Even Haman's timing is perfect in the purposes of God. God's providence works in harmony with man's freedom. It never coerces people. The king made his own decisions. Haman made his own arrangements, and he built his own gallows. The same was true of Mordecai and Esther, yet they made their decisions in the sphere of God's sovereignty. Haman built his own gallows for Mordecai, but God hanged Haman on it. God is great enough to give people genuine freedom and yet cause things to turn out the way he wants them to. The invisible hand of God is evident everywhere. We ask the same thing sometimes in our life. Where is God? Why so silent? This morning I was reading out of Swindoll, and I just want to read this real quick. Indeed, how unsearchable are his judgments, and unfathomable are his ways. Now be careful, that does not mean that he's not in touch, out of control, and he doesn't have a plan. It just means he isn't obligated to explain himself. And because he doesn't reveal everything, we're left with three very honest words which are helpful coming from the lips of otherwise proud people. And what are those three words? I don't know. In the final analysis, God knows, and he does all things well. He is in charge. I am the clay. He is the potter. I am the disciple. He is the Lord. I am the sheep. He is the shepherd. I am the servant. He is the master. That means I am to submit myself. I am to humble myself under his mighty hand. I must be willing to adjust my life to his choices for me, to listen, to learn, to adapt to his leading wherever it may go, whether I'm comfortable, happy, or healthy. That is obedience. Job by now is beginning to see it, and when he reaches the end of his brief explanation, he wisely asks, "Who can understand?" Train yourself to think theologically. Make it your determined purpose to think God's thoughts after him, acknowledging his lofty magnificence. Teach yourself to be at ease, saying the words, "I don't know." Because Job thought correctly about God, he was able to endure even while not understanding why. May his tribe increase, and may it include you. Again, we ask the same thing. Sometimes in our life, where is God? Why so silent? Just like Job did. But I want to tell you the end of that passage where Job asked that question, "Where are you, Lord?" He comes to the realization, and at the end of the chapter, he says, "He knows the way that I take. And when he tries me, I shall come forth as gold." We need to understand that there is a divine architect ordering every detail. He is accomplishing his perfect will, and we can rest in that. How wonderful to live in that confidence. Question I have this morning is, do we believe it? Guys, have a great day. Again, it's good to be here with you all. Can't wait to the time when we can all be together. Father, thank you for this time. Thank you for your word. Thank you for your promises, Lord, that we might draw near to you and trust you every minute of our lives. In Jesus' name, amen.